you familiar with a magazine called Sports Collector's Digest?
No, I can't say that I am.
Well, it's primarily for the benefit of baseball card and memorabilia collectors. But in addition to that sort of stuff, it has a little writing on baseball about players. And I freelance, but I write for them, and mostly I send interviews with former players, and the baseball fans like to read these things. So this is what we're talking about, this being in.
Okay, that's fine.
I'll ask you, 12, 14, 15 questions, and you know, whatever kind of answer you want to give, as short or as long as you want, just feel free. Okay, well, let's hit the road then. Who did you sign with originally?
I signed with the Detroit minor league system in 1954 after high school.
Where they sent you, I've got your record right here, I don't need to ask you that question. They sent you to Paul's Valley?
Well, yeah, I went to Jamestown, New York first. I don't know if that's listed on.
No, it's not.
Didn't play up there. That was Class D, and then Paul Valley, and then
was that Oklahoma?
Yes, That was in the Sooner State League.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You had over the years in the minors, you had two or three excellent years. You had one outstanding year and a couple other real good ones. Did the Tigers ever take you to spring training?
No, they never did. I had a chance at one time to go. I played in 1958. I played with Toronto, and that was AAA.
Mm-hmm.
And I went in the service after the season was over for 6 months of active training. And when I came out in March, I think it was, or April, I would have had a chance. At that time, they had put me on the major league roster, and I had a chance, if I would have chosen to do so, for 15 days, I could have gone to Detroit and played with them for 15 days, and then if I would have stayed, I would have stayed. Chances are I wouldn't have, though, because I came out without having any spring training, basically, and so I chose not to, and I went to Charleston. And I stayed there for a month, I guess, and then I wasn't really playing a lot and hitting too well, so they sent me down to Panama City and Birmingham in 59. And so I hit well down there. I think I hit 295. And so I guess if I had it to do over again, that may have been. Might have been wise to go with Detroit for 15 days just to see what it was like and get a taste of it. But I guess I decided maybe at that time it was in the best interest not to.
It's kind of hard going in cold.
Well, having not played a lot, I've played a lot of minor league ball, and I hit probably about 295 for lifetime in the minors. And I did have some good years, but... at that time, Detroit really, there wasn't a spot, I guess, of it. And I was thinking, it's probably going to be a long time off. I did play 6 years in the minor leagues, and before I saw my first major league pitch, I had to go to bat 2,000, I think it was 558 times at bat.
Wow.
In the minor leagues. So when I got to the major leagues, I really appreciated it, and that was in 1960 when... Kansas City drafted me from, from the Detroit minor league system, and for $25,000. And if I either had to stay with them all year, and if I did, then they had to pay Detroit $25,000, which they did. And if they would have returned me to Detroit, they would have lost $12,500. But I played as a utility infielder that year, and I only hit 205, which wasn't really that great. But then I was drafted after the 60 season by the new expansion Washington club, and however, I didn't start the season with them in 61. They sent me to Rochester, and that was kind of a blessing, because I went down there, I was really kind of disgusted, because I felt there were some guys I could have beat out with a major league club, but they sent me to Rochester, and I hit 332, I think it was.
Mm-hmm. Drove a whole bunch of runs and not too many at-bats.
66 runs scored something like that in half a season. I probably would have been MVP of the league that year. I think Ted Savage was, but I really, and I had 16 home runs. I had one more home run than Boog Powell, and Boog and I played together in Rochester. But the main thing that that did for me, it accomplished two things. Gave me the confidence that I needed to go back and play, stay, but it also gave me a chance to play with a Baltimore AAA farm team. And then subsequently, after the 62 season, I was traded over to Baltimore, and I think they felt that I could help their ball club with, you know, having played with their AAA club, and I was over there even as a member of Washington. I didn't belong to Baltimore, but I did have a chance to show them a few things, play more than one position. So they brought Pete Burnside and I in on a trade after 62, and then I wound up being a utility infielder for them for a little over 4 years.
Well, when Morstan called you back up, you raised your batting average to 90 points. Was this just due to the confidence you gained at Rochester?
Yeah, I think so. It really, I mean, I couldn't do anything wrong in Rochester, but I hit everything hard, and I just had a whale of a year and hit a two-run single to beat Boston 2-0 in the All-Star game, and was playing short and second and third. And when I came back, I knew I could play, and I wound up hitting 295, and then I hit 288 the next year, so I knew I could play.
Mm-hmm.
And I was an aggressive hitter, and it was just knowing that you could do it. And so it was, when I came back, I was probably more thought of as a hitter than I was an infielder. But having played all infield positions except first base, and I didn't play that until I was with Baltimore, that really was a blessing in disguise for me, because I could see the any longevity would be maybe related to playing more than one position, and that's what I encourage kids today to do, even in high school or whatever it might be. Play more than one position, because then you get a chance to play a lot longer wherever you happen to be playing.
That's good advice. You only had the one year, 62, in Washington, where you, I don't know if it's the word is regular or everyday player or whatever, but where you were in the lineup almost every day, but you never had a position.
No, I played, I played short in 61, and then they turned me over to third base, and I played third all year at Washington, and played pretty much every day, and the results were 288, so I guess as I look back, the times that I did play over a period of time and went to bat 200 times, I hit fairly well.
Yeah, you had some very good years with the bat. What was your best position?
Well, I think second base was a good position. Short was the toughest one to play, but I enjoyed playing second. And of course, at Baltimore, with Aparicio at short and Brooks and I roomed together for 4 years over in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to know him real well. But you're not going to play third base in Baltimore.
No, not a lot.
Boog is at first, and so second base is the one I wanted to kind of concentrate on. But I felt that I was better off trying to assume a good attitude and try to stay in shape and play a utility role. And in 64, I had 15 hits, and I led the major leagues in pinch hitting that year.
Well, three times you led in total pinch hits, and I guess it was about the time you came to Baltimore, somebody discovered you could pinch hit. You were probably one of the top two or three pinch hitters of your time.
Well, I guess when you look at strictly right-hand pinch hitting, at one time, I think when I retired, I think I had the most hits of any right-hander in baseball, and there was a guy named Fothergill that was ahead of me in number of hits, and I wound up with 66. Merv Rettman and I had the same number of pinch hits, but since then, a number of pinch hitters, right-handers, have surpassed 66, but most good pinch hitters were left-handed, and because of the predominantly right-hand pitching And I think one of the best compliments I ever had was when Geets Brown was with Detroit, and I'm not sure if he was playing or coaching, but they asked him to name the five best pinch hitters that he was aware of, and I think he listed Smokey Burgess was first, and then he had Morales, and I think he had me down as fifth, so that was I felt real complimented. And I guess I enjoyed pinch hitting. It's something that most guys would prefer to play every day, but I knew it was difficult, but I think it was kind of a mind over matter. I knew when I went up there, if I could have three good swings, at least I might be able to make contact. And I'd have to check this out, but I think I may be one of the few players in Major League history to hit 272 for a lifetime average and 272 for a pinch hit average.
There's very, very few. There are a couple who batted higher as a pinch hitter than they did overall.
I wonder how many hit the same.
At the same, other than the guys that maybe played three or four games, I doubt there's anybody that had your career as long as you played and as many times as you batted that maintained the same average.
Mm-hmm.
Why were you such a successful pinch hitter?
Well, I like to do it. I didn't mind. I was a pretty swinger, and I was aggressive hitter, and I just felt that if I could go up there and, you know, you just kind of sit on the bench and determine what the guy's throwing, and you're either going to be facing somebody who's got a pretty good game going, who's still remaining in the ball game, and in those days, I mean, they didn't have six-inning pitchers. These guys were either going all the way or else they brought in the ace of the pen, and so you knew you were going to be facing a guy that had his stuff together that day or else somebody coming in from the pen. So it was just trying to, adjust mentally in preparation for that kind of a role, and I enjoyed doing it because I felt that I was further ahead than most guys because they didn't like to do it, and I did. And so it gave me a good feeling about being able to do something that maybe most guys would prefer to play every day. And if I was called on to play, that was fine too. But I did enjoy pinch hitting, and having had a little success was, I think it extended my career what it did. I found out early that if I was going to stay any length of time, maybe I need to play more than one position. And subsequently, wound up playing 10 years, so it was worthwhile having played a number of positions.
You played for a number of teams, too. You played for 8 teams overall in both leagues. What city? Was Baltimore the place you enjoyed most?
Yes, I think so. I really enjoyed playing in Baltimore. And I guess the other town that I maybe enjoyed was Kansas City. Kansas City had such a great ballpark, and George Toma was the groundskeeper there. And Kansas City is more probably like a Minneapolis and St. Paul area, and I really enjoyed playing there. I had some guys that I got along real well with, like Norm Seaburn and Lumpy and Herzog and Dick Williams, and we had a real, and Hank Bauer. It's interesting that Hank Bauer and I played most of my career with Hank Bauer. In 60 as a player, he was still playing, and then wind up with him in Baltimore as a coach in 63, and then as a manager 64, 5, 6, and then I pick him up again in 69 in Oakland as a manager. So I probably played over half my major league career with Bauer, but we had some real good ball players, and today, if you would have taken that ball club in 60 and put it in the American League, I think you might have had a pretty good ball club. We had guys that we finished last, of course, but there were only 16 major league teams at that time.
Right. You were traded. Well, obviously, been on 8 teams. You were traded a lot. How did the trades affect you? Did they bother you?
No, they really didn't, because I looked at it, I guess sometimes when you look at that, you say journeyman, but when I look at the teams that I was traded to, I was traded to better teams all the time.
Yeah, you were.
And so I think when you're a utility ball player, you're maybe a little vulnerable, but you're also, you're bait for somebody that needs somebody to fill in.
Mm-hmm.
If they're looking for a pinch hitter, right-hand pinch hitter, and utility infielder, then you may be available. So I guess I was complimented to go to, you know, to certainly Baltimore and the Mets. I thought going there might not be the best interest of my career, but it wound up being the best year I ever had in baseball. I mean, with the exception of Idaho Falls in 56, hitting .348 and had, I think, 80 hits and 230 at-bats. So I really, mm-hmm. I really had a great season, and especially after getting traded in Baltimore, feeling that maybe I was, through with my career or maybe ready to retire and then come back and play against the left-hand pitching and do well. I was really, that really got me off a kind of a second wind. And in the National League, I hit .301, and the American League, I hit .262 for a combined .272. So I did go to a number of teams, but I was pleased the ones that I did play with.
And you produced everywhere you were.
The only time I didn't was Cincinnati. I pulled a leg muscle the last day of spring training, and I just never recovered from that. And then they sent me to Atlanta, and I go down and play third base. Cleet Boyer got hurt, and I played to hit .262 the whole season down there. So I played every day after I got reported there when Pappas and Davidson and I were traded down there from Cincinnati. And then going to St. Louis was a break. But when I got over there, probably the most uncomfortable feeling I had in the major leagues was playing with St. Louis. I just felt out of position for some reason. A lot of talent, a lot of dollars. I guess I just felt like kind of an outsider, and it wasn't because they were trying to make me feel that way, but I just felt the pressure of trying to produce under, with those kind of guys.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed playing pretty much every place that I did. The Mets I enjoyed playing. Of course, I didn't do so well, but Baltimore was probably the most enjoyable, and I did enjoy playing at Kansas City, too.
This is probably I don't know if it's an unfair question, but it's a difficult question. You were a legitimate major league hitter. There was very little question about that. You had a little speed. You may not have been the fastest guy, but you could run the bases. Today, would you be an everyday player?
Yeah, I think I probably would, because I think I would have been able to hit well enough. You know, you got guys. Today, if I was playing today, I'd be making $500,000, $500,000.
Anyhow.
I think I would have been able to carry my weight with the bat. I think I would have been able to do some pinch or designated hitting. There's some guys today that are playing, being used as a designated hitter that aren't necessarily long ball hitters.
That's for sure.
But I think if I wouldn't have played every day, I know I would have played a great deal, especially like a team like here with the Twins. Kelly gives these guys a lot of chance to play, and he keeps them in shape, and he keeps them sharp, and he maintains a good attitude on the ball club by doing that. And it's hard to say. If I take the times I went to bat 200 times or more in the major leagues, I probably hit better than .270. So it wouldn't have really made any difference. I chances are I would have played a lot more today, though, because I could swing the bat.
Mm-hmm. Is there, in your, you said 10 years, you played 11 years.
Well, I played 11. Actually, my pension is 9 3/4.
Oh, because you had the part years, yeah.
Yeah, because
right.
I had some part years there. So, just under 10 years for a career as far as pension is concerned.
Is there a particular game or feat that you accomplished or something that stands out in your mind above other things?
Well, probably three things. The number one was the first thrill I had in baseball was hitting the first home run in D.C. Stadium in 1962 when President Kennedy was there, and that was opening day.
Yeah, well, that's impressive.
And that was a big thrill. And I had went 3-for-4 off Don Mossy and felt like I was going to play in the All-Star game, but had to play another 80 games. So didn't make it. But then the next thrill was in 64. getting six consecutive pinch hits for an American League record, which stood for 17 years until Bill Stein broke that in 81.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still a Baltimore pinch hit record. And I think also I had, at that time, during that year, I had eight consecutive base hits, too. So, but and then after that would have been playing in a World Series, or I shouldn't say playing in a World Series, as a member of the Orioles, I never got in a game. We had 25 eligible, only 13 played. The only pitchers that pitched were McNally started, Grabowski came in and pitched 6 2/3 innings of one hit ball. And then Bunker came back and won six to nothing. We won that first game 5-2, and then we went 6-0, and then we go back to Baltimore, and Palmer wins 1-0, and then McNally comes back and wins again 1-0. So we only used four pitchers. The only other position we alternated at was Blair and Snyder. So we 13 guys played. 12 of us never got in a game, including Stu Miller, who was our relief pitcher.
I remember that series that, Baltimore could have shown up with their starting nine, I think.
And they had Drysdale and Koufax, and Willie Davis dropped the two big fly balls in center field the first inning, and after that they never recovered. They only scored one run after the first six outs of the game. They never recovered.
Well, that's one of the most lopsided World Series.
Yeah, one reason we did it was because Frank Robinson, when I joined the club in 66 in spring training, Frank was talking about the World Series already, and I remember at the batting cage, first day I'm out there in the shower room, Frank brought a dimension to complement Brooks, and they're the dynamic duo the whole year, and they picked us up, and Frank was a tremendous ball player. He was the only guy that ever be an MVP in both leagues, and I can see why. He just was a super ball player, but he brought some leadership over, and where Brooks was able to kind of, together, the two of them really had provided the leadership that we needed.
You mentioned both the Robinsons. Who is the best player you saw?
In baseball?
Yes.
I think probably Aaron, when I played with him at Atlanta. Kind of a silent ball player, never said much, he just went out and did his job. I was really impressed with Aaron. Aaron was one of the few guys I could ever notice that could go from the dugout to right field or his position and never have to really warm up too much. He just had a tremendous body to be able to do that, and he had the great wrist hitting, but I guess of the guys I played against or with, I'd have to say Aaron. Mays and Mantle would be in that category, but I didn't know them as well.
Mm-hmm.
But Aaron he could do everything. He could run the bases, he could steal the base, he could just do it all.
All right, two-part question. Who was the who was the best pitcher you ever saw, and who was the toughest pitcher on you?
Well, I think the toughest pitcher for me to hit would have been Dick Hall, and I played with him in Baltimore, and Hall had that herky-jerky motion, and he threw that slider, and he just beat you up with that slider when I was with Kansas City, and he knew it was coming. He still couldn't wait, and he was the toughest one for me. I think maybe another one would have been McDowell, but I used to get that quail off McDowell each time. You get at least one hit off him, but I think Dick Hall was one of the toughest ones. And, I guess two pitchers that if I had to go into a double header and I needed two guys to pitch for me, one would be Gibson and the other one would be Seaver. I saw their intestinal fortitude because I played on that same ball club, and you give them the ball and they're going out there and they're gonna get them.
I think you'd stand a pretty good chance with those two.
Yeah, I just was very impressed with those two guys. They just And when you look at guys like Drysdale, I faced Drysdale in spring training, and I used to hit him. I used to get three hits a game off him. For some reason, I could hit Drysdale. Koufax, I never faced in a game, but there were some great pitchers back in those days.
Yeah, there sure were. You mentioned designated hitter a few minutes ago. That's one of the changes. I guess it's been 30 years since you first signed a contract, or since you Well, since you first came to the majors, it's been 35 since you first signed a contract, I guess.
Right.
What about the changes? There have been a whole bunch of changes. What do you think of them? And are they for the better or for the worse?
Well, I guess, I think the designated hitter thing is good to, in some respects. It's been good for the American League, I guess. It gives a little more offense to the game, and yet if you go to the National League, they don't want any part of it because they like to have the maneuvering that you do. And I can see a need to have 25 guys on a team rather than 24 if you're going to not use a designated hitter. So I guess a manager, it's got to be a country club for a manager to have a designated hitter rather than having to have go out and make all the moves and pull the outfielder when you change pitchers so that pitcher doesn't hit the first time up next inning.
So I think there's
more of a cat and mouse game in the National League. I personally felt that the National League was a better league, and I'll tell you why. I saw the National League hit and run, steal, very aggressive base running, always trying to steal a run from you, always trying to get that one or two runs ahead. In the American League, it was more or less, and I think it is to some extent even today maybe, sit back and wait for the big inning, wait for the home run to bail you out.
Mm-hmm.
And it was tougher to play in the National League because, as an infielder, because there was so much aggressiveness on the bases, a lot of speed, good defense, and so you had to be on your toes all the time. I thought it was easier to play in the American League than the National League. However, I hit 301 as a lifetime average in the National League, which said to me that they throw a few more fastballs. At least they did over there. In the American League, if you couldn't hit a breaking ball when I was playing, you were in trouble. And I think they maybe throw a few more fastballs over here today than they did before, but...
I think you're right. I think the reputation is still the same.
Yeah, I like the National League. I mean, Jenkins, you know, I hit a couple home runs off him, and he's still going to challenge you. He still thinks you can't hit the front. I fortunately was a high ball hitter, and you're going to find more guys throw the ball upstairs and downstairs. But outside of that, the changes, I guess there's got to be, it would have been tough to, you know, you probably have to take 250 ball players out of the major leagues today, you know, if you go back, because there's 10 more teams in the major leagues today, and, you know, that's 250 ball players. And if you took 250 ball players out of the major leagues today, you'd have a pretty good bunch of guys when you get down to the guys that are still there.
I think. All right.
But it's a different game. They push guys a little quicker. They don't have the minor leagues like they did before. And you could get buried in the minor leagues. There were guys that never played major league ball that could have certainly played today. But unfortunately, they just never had a chance with 16 teams.
Yeah, it was a lot tougher competition, I'm sure. You mentioned what you thought you'd get $500,000 today. I think anything, that would be easy for you today. What was your best salary?
I think I got $26,000 in 1970. You know, and back in those days, you'd have a good year and you'd get $2,000-$3,000 raise. And maybe that's not saying much for my ability to negotiate, but there weren't those kind of raises being passed out. And of course, you knew you were going to have to play with the same team. You weren't, the only way you're going to move to someplace else is a trade or you know, being sold.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a different game. I don't begrudge the ball player for what he's making today at all. And yet, I think that they're outrageous. The salaries, they're unrealistic. But two things did that. One was when Messersmith was able to sign as a free agent back in those days, and Catfish Hunter, you know, they led the way to the free agency, and then also the large television contracts today. If they weren't giving those kind of dollars out, they wouldn't be paying those kind of salaries either.
Well, they complain about how much they're paying, but I don't think that anybody's going to pay it if they can't afford to.
Yeah.
So
no,
it's...
that's right. They have the deferred arrangements and everything, but listen, if a ball player can get $3 million bucks like Herbeck and Pawtucket and they're able to do that. It's just in 20 years you wouldn't think that you'd go from Brooks in 20 when he was playing. I think his last year, I don't think Brooks ever made over $150,000. And today, he'd probably be the first $3 million player.
Oh, anyhow, yeah.
But that's okay, too. It's a different game. I guess the thing I dislike about the long-term contracts is maybe the lack of hustle maybe on the part of some of them. When you know you're going to get paid for 2-3 years, I'm not sure that's a great incentive. It becomes more of a Wall Street lawyer approach than going out and trying to be a back alley fighter. I just think that has been somewhat of a detriment. Not to a guy like Puckett, because I think he'll go out and battle all the time. But I'm just not sure that there's always going to be 100% put out on the basis of long term contracts.
I think you're right. There's several that come to mind that production seems to taper off as soon as they get that guaranteed 3 or 4 years.
And if they do sign a 3-year contract, doggone it, they shouldn't be able to negotiate or renegotiate. That's just admitting that you're a dumbbell for signing a 3-year. And what you did, and I respect the owners, and I respect the Vikings, because Lynn is tough on that. And I just don't think if a guy signs, he should be willing to accept that. And if he's not happy, then don't sign. But don't sign and then say, I'm not.